It is 9 o'clock, so we will start now. We ended last class. I was talking about the Ben Ish Chai's grave, where it was, and I pointed out that although there's no question that it's located in Baghdad, there is this story that it was his body was magically transported to Jerusalem and buried here on the Mount of Olives, where it's the only tombstone which is standing up. We also read the tombstone last class that it spoke mentions that the person who did the burial came to this Rabbi Ben Sion Chazan, who I should clarify is a well-known person in the Iraqi community. He's the individual, first of all, who published a number of the Ben Ish Chai's works. Second of all, he's important for another reason. I mentioned this last class, but I neglected to refer to him by name. In 1948, during the siege of Jerusalem, it was two rabbis, Ben Sion. Yeah, Ben Sion Chazan. Just look at his name here. It's listed on the tombstone. And Rabbi Yisrael Zev Mintzberg, who was also a somewhat important posek in Jerusalem during the 40s and the 1950s. They were the ones who took out the white flag and surrendered before the Haganah. And once they did that, the people followed them. That led to the fall of the old city. So that is Ben Sion Chazan. One more thing I want to mention about the grave is just I did a search online and I came up with a not a responsum, but I guess you can call it a responsum of Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu of Tzfat, who's the son of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu is really the crown prince of the Iraqi community. He's the one who remained loyal to the Ben Ish Chai, and it's his son who ran for chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Believe me when I tell you that it's a bracha. He wasn't chosen as chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Just to go to look around a little bit online. Look on Wikipedia, read other things in Hebrew about the things that Shmuel Eliyahu has been involved with, and take my word, by which I mean extremely right-wing politics, and not just right-wing politics, all sorts of statements that would have made it much more difficult for the state of Israel. Having said that, he is a great Talmud Chacham, and he does carry on a certain tradition, not exactly of his father, but to a certain extent. And he was asked this question: where is the Ben Ish Chai buried? And not surprisingly, he answers that the Ben Ish Chai is buried in Baghdad. And he says, "Al zeh ein machoket." There's no doubt about that. No dispute. I don't know if that's true. There's no dispute. We're looking at tombstones, so some people think differently. And he says, "But there are those who say shenishmato alta." That his soul came up to the land of Israel and is in a certain place on Har Zeitim. I don't know what that means, his soul came up, but what he's saying is that don't take this seriously, that he physically is buried there. I like to think that the people who come to this grave and assume he's buried there don't really realize the history. That he's buried in Baghdad, although maybe that's wishful thinking because the people who come will be Israelis and they could read what the tombstone says. So I don't know what to make of it other than that there is no doubt that the Ben Ish Chai is buried in Baghdad, as I said last class. Rav Kaduri, who is the leading Kabbalist of the Iraqis, had nothing to say about this business of being buried in Jerusalem. He said, this is all a mistake, and he's buried in Baghdad. So if you ever meet someone who thinks he's buried in, who actually does think he's buried in Jerusalem, let me know. We've been talking the whole time about the Ben Ish Chai, and using his, we haven't referred to him by his name, Rav Yosef Chaim, we've called him the Ben Ish Chai, and that is his most important work. It is divided into Parshat HaShavua, and it goes for 2 years, as is a two-year cycle. It has halachot from Orachayim and Yeridea, and it's, I think we'd be fair in calling it a Sephardic Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. He also has a section of Ben Ish Chai, which is what we could say is Drush, Homiletics, and he has another work in homiletics called Ben Ish Chayil. As I mentioned, it's a priyuchtiv in the Pasuk, Ben Ish Chai, Ben Ish Chayil. He also wrote Responsa, four volumes of Responsa. The title is Rav Pe'alim. Again, that's, if you look in Tanakh, in the Pasuk that refers to the Ben Ish Chai, and all the other works of his titles of his books, you'll see the term Rav Pe'alim as well. And in the back of Rav Pe'alim, you'll find a section called Sod Yisharim, which are questions, responsa on Kabbalah. This is the first example, and to this date, one of the only works of responsa focusing on Kabbalah. Before mentioning, before going into some of these responsa, let me just mention something that appears on Kabbalah, not in the Sod Yisharim, because Sod Yisharim just deals with questions on Kabbalah. I'm referring to Rav Pe'alim, which are his halachic responsa. In Volume 1, Yordan number 56, he discusses the fact that in Bombay, as we mentioned, there was a nice Iraqi community in Bombay, Mumbai today. In Mumbai, someone published an Arabic translation of a section of the Zohar. And the Ben Ish Chai writes about this and says that this is absolutely wrong. Why is it wrong? He says, we don't want the masses to read the Zohar, that is, to understand what they're reading. The masses in the Sephardic world often read the Zohar as a form of piety, like people might read Tehillim. But we don't want the masses to read it and understand it, because if they do, they might take certain anthropomorphic passages literally, passages that describe God, his form, and all these sorts of things. Sexual passages, there's all sorts of things in the Zohar that if you take it literally and not symbolic, that's really heretical. And he says further that a few years before this, he had rebuked someone who translated Shir HaShirim into Arabic. Again, the reason was that people will see it in its translation and they'll assume it's just a love song. I think it's worth noting that Art Scroll has taken a lot of abuse. Because Art Scroll, if you look at the translation, and if you look at the Machzor, for instance, the Pesach Machzor, when you read Shir HaShirim, there's no translation, a literal translation. There's simply a figurative translation. So everything, it's a Targum, basically. It's what Art Scroll did. They didn't invent this. This is what's found in the Targum. But until the days of the Targum, until modern times, you never had a so-called translation like Art Scroll. Nevertheless, we see from the Ben Ish Chai that the Art Scroll is not the first to say that a literal translation is not just misleading, it's incorrect. The issue with this always is, I wrote about this on the Sfarim blog, is that if you look in the commentaries, they all assume that you need to understand the literal translation, and then from there, you moved into the allegorical translation. But the Ben Ish Chai, and I don't think the Ben Ish Chai was arguing with this, but he didn't want the masses to be exposed to the literal translation. I think Art Scroll goes further, in that they see no purpose whatsoever for the literal translation, which, by the way, if you look at the Art Scroll Shir HaShirim, the separate volume of Shir HaShirim, they have the actual translation, which they give you, is the Midrashic translation meaning, but in the notes, in the commentary, they do tell you what the words mean literally. And if you read Rav Gifter's approbation at the outset of the book, he recognizes that there is value to the literal translation of it. But the Ben Ish Chai says, no translation for the masses. And Art Scroll, as I said, sort of follows in this tradition. If you look in the Machzor, where they don't even provide you with the literal translation, but if you look at the Art Scroll Shir HaShirim, there they do give you, and not just the Machzor, I think in the back of the Stone Chumash, also you don't get the literal translation, but they do give you the literal translation in the separate volume, in which case the Ben Ish Chai will be just as upset with Art Scroll as he would be with everyone else who translates it. The problem with this approach of Art Scroll, and obviously the Ben Ish Chai, but you can't blame the Ben Ish Chai because he lived before the modern state of Israel, but you could say this to Art Scroll, is that it's unfair to non-Hebrew speakers. That is, every Israeli, even the secular Israeli, the unlearned Israeli, they can pick up the Shir HaShirim and they can read it and understand it. It's only the non-Hebrew speakers who are treated like the masses and are not given the actual translation. To my knowledge, no one has said that the masses in Israel, who now are Hebrew-speaking, should not be able to read the actual Shir HaShirim, that we should provide for them a substitute text, a Targumic-type text. So from my perspective, as long as the masses in Israel, by virtue of the fact that they're born in Israel, can read the actual Shir HaShirim, I don't see the reason why we have to prevent everyone else in the masses in America from seeing the literal translation. Furthermore, he says that in this response, he says about Shir HaShirim that the non-Jews will see the translation, and this will lead to ridicule of Judaism, since they too, the non-Jews, will see it and take literally certain passages that were not meant to be taken literally. Obviously, he's writing from a Sephardic environment, from an Arabic world, where they don't know the Bible, and the Quran is their sacred text. Because in Europe, every Christian had a Bible that did have the Song of Songs literally. So the idea that we can't translate it into German or French or Russian or whatever, because the non-Jews will see it, that wouldn't apply in the Christian world at all. And let me just add that the Christians have had the translation of the Song of Songs for almost 2,000 years, and it has not led to ridicule of Judaism. It hasn't led to ridicule of anything, because they see this as a holy text. But I understand his point. In the Islamic world, he thought this was problematic. The idea that the Song of Songs literally is a problem, it also is not so clear to me. There was a rabbi named Raphael Breuer. He was from the famous Breuer family, the son of the Rav of Frankfurt, Shlomo Breuer. And he was a rabbi in Aschaffenburg in Germany. He wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs. He wrote two commentaries. One of them was Al Pi Hapshat, according to the literal meaning. And you can make a case, as he does, that Judaism does not frown upon man and woman, husband and wife, that his point basically is that true love between man and woman is holy. And that's exactly what the Song of Songs is writing about. Despite the fact that he made this case, and he was one of the leading rabbis in Germany, and he was what we call a separatist rabbi, one of the extremist rabbis, the response to him was quite strong, and it was one of the reasons why he never became rabbi in Frankfurt. There was such an outcry over the fact that a rabbi would write a literal commentary on the Song of Songs. It had a real impact on his future career chances. I don't think today anyone would bat an eye if he wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs, acknowledging that there's also an allegorical meaning, but interpreting it in line with the love of husband and wife. What else did the Ben Ishlai write? He wrote Benayahu. Again, the same psukim refers to this, and Ben Yehoyada. These are commentaries on the Talmud, but on the Agadic sections, mostly on the Agadic sections, and as well as a number of other books published posthumously. But what I mentioned are the most important. So let's talk about some of these works now. He also wrote a book, before I go further, he wrote a book called Torah Lishma. It's a book of responsa. You can go on HebrewBooks.org and take a look at it. This is a work of responsa attributed to an otherwise unknown rabbi, but it was actually written by the Ben Ishlai. There is no doubt at all about this. This unknown rabbi, the name he's given is Yecheskel Kecheli, and if you add up the gematria of his name, it comes to Yosef Chaim. We do not know why he published this book under a pseudonym. He did publish a number of small books anonymously, not under a pseudonym, but this he published under a pseudonym. If he had published this in the name of a known scholar, it would obviously be forgery. But he didn't. He published it he made up a name. He published it in the name of, I can't recall now. I have to check. Whether he made up the name, or if I'm not mistaken, his name is mentioned in an old source, but it doesn't, we know nothing about this person, no writing, it's just a name. But I can't recall now whether, let me take that back. I think he made up the name himself. Something Roche attributes it to some person who's mentioned in by the Beit Yosef. This, he just made up the name. So since he just made up the name, it's like a pen name. It's a pseudonym. It's like Mark Twain or anything like that. The difference is, it's not a pen name in the sense that everyone knew who Mark Twain was. Rather, and it's not a pen name in the sense that it's a pseudonym where a contemporary is writing under a pseudonym. This rabbi who he attributes it to, and according to the book itself, you see, this lived supposedly in the 17th century. So what's the Ben Ishchai doing writing a book of responsa and attributing it to a person who lived in the 17th century? We know that it couldn't have been written in the 17th century, quite apart from the fact that we know that the Ben Ishchai wrote it because that's the tradition in Baghdad, and there's all sorts of other allusions that give it away. But the Torah Lishma cites books that were published after this rabbi was supposed to have lived. These are cases when the Ben Ishchai doesn't realize when the books were first published. However, in other cases, when Reb Ben Ishchai was aware that the books he wants to cite only appeared after this rabbi was supposed to have lived in the 17th century, he refers to the books he wants to quote as being in manuscript. So he has the rabbi say that I have a manuscript of the response of the Rashba. Now, the Rashba only were published, let's say, in the 18th century, and he's living in the 17th century, supposedly. So he gets out of this by saying that he has a manuscript of it. The problem is that he wants to cite a work called Besamim Rosh. Besamim Rosh is a forgery published by a man in the 18th century named Shaul Berlin. We can have a whole class on the Besamim Rosh. And he attributes it to various Rishonim, including the Rosh. That's why it's called Besamim Rosh. But not all the responses, some are by the Rashba and others. The Ben Ishchai, unfortunately, was taken in by this forgery, as were many other great sages, and he thought it was authentic. And he wanted to cite it, but he couldn't cite it because it was only published in the 18th century. So in his 17th century persona, as Rabbi Yecheskel Kecheli, he says that I have a manuscript of this responsa, and now we know, of course, that this only later appears in the Besamim Rosh. But there was no manuscript of the Besamim Rosh. It was all invented by Shaul Berlin. So that also gives away his tactic. What the Besamim Rosh is, it's an attempt to undermine traditional Judaism. There's a series of reformist responsa in there. So most of the responsa are pretty standard, but there's a number of responsa that really tear at the essence of traditional Judaism, which is... Because of that, it's amazing that so many great rabbis were taken in by this. But some of them say, well, only these few responsa are forgeries, the rest are authentic. It's clear, I think, that the whole volume is a forgery. Now, the Ben Ishchai, we're going to come back to his responsa in a couple minutes. But let me just tell you about his other works. The Ben Ishchai also wrote a work in Arabic, in Hebrew letters, which... By the way, the idea of the Hebrew letters are important. I don't know why Ben Ishchai was so upset with the translation of Shir HaShirim into Arabic, because it wasn't translated into Arabic, literary Arabic. It was translated into Judeo-Arabic, and the Muslims can't read Judeo-Arabic anyway. Either as it may, he did write a book in Arabic, in Hebrew letters, of course, which is how Jews read Arabic, which is translated, it was translated to Hebrew, it's also been translated to English, as Chukei Nashim. Chukei Nashim means laws of women, which deals with not just laws, though laws relating to women, women's issues. It deals with general mussar he gives to women. It's like a woman's textbook. Not just laws of nida, things like that, but all sorts of things. One of the things we learned from this book, quite interesting, is that women in Baghdad did not eat in the sukkah. But they did sleep in the sukkah, because their husbands were sleeping. If their husband was sleeping in the sukkah, they're going to sleep in the sukkah. But they didn't. Now, I've been to people's houses, especially when I was in Israel, and I remember one time where we were sitting on this veranda, and there was a tiny, tiny sukkah, so it could only fit me and two other men, so the women sat inside. But generally, we don't, you know, if we have room, the women come out, why not? But women are not obligated in sitting in the sukkah, and the practice in Baghdad, and we'll see other interesting practices, was that it had nothing to do with the size of the sukkah, but the men sat in the sukkah. It was a men's thing. Men in the sukkah, women inside the house. I don't know of anywhere else in the Jewish world where women, as a matter of routine, did not eat in the sukkah. We also learn that women in Baghdad on the night of Rosh Chodesh would light two or four candles, just as a, they didn't make a bracha or anything, but just as an indication that it was Rosh Chodesh. And one more thing of interest, when women left their homes in Baghdad, they did exactly like the Muslim women did. They covered their faces. That was the practice. This goes back already to the Rambam. The Rambam mentions women covering their faces. In this work, Chukei Nashim, there are also many stories, not just from Chazal, but from medieval Hebrew literature, as well as from Arabic literature. There were numerous books following Rav Yosef Haim's death that were published. There have been books of his published in the last 10 years, including the so-called Mekabtzio, which I told you was not really Mekabtzio, that was published last year. Let me talk, though, about some of the responses of the Rav Pehali, because he has a number, out of four volumes, so you're going to have a full of valuable and interesting material, but a number of the responses which have made an impact and are quite significant. But before getting to that, let me tell you what he says in his introduction to the Rav Pehali. The introduction to Volume 1. He has a programmatic introduction, which it's also somewhat unique, in which he talks about the different methods used by authors of responsa. He begins by saying there are some who simply look at the earlier sources and just follow what's stated there. They have no originality. They'll say they know what the Shulchan Aruch says, so that the Shulchan Aruch's rule applies to this case and not that case. But that's it. He says that these people are not worthy of being called, they can be called Chacham, Chakim actually, but they're not called rabbi. So you can call them a wise man, but not a rabbi. Why not? Because there's no originality here. In other words, someone who knows the entire Shulchan Aruch and knows what to do, that he's wise, but he's not a rabbi. A rabbi, a rav, for him is one, as he explains in the next paragraph, is someone who is able to use originality and make comparisons, all the things that you need to do. He discovers new things, he applies them to, takes the old rules, applies them to new situations, everything you'd expect. He then starts speaking about the characteristics, the personal characteristics of what I will refer to as meshivim. A meshiv is one who answers a lot of questions. He says, for those who want to see, this is the fourth paragraph, he says that some of them are very modest, correct, very modest, even self-effacing. He says they begin a response by saying, you know, you, who am I to answer such a question? We've all seen this. And he says others don't act this way. They just give their opinion. He does not like the people who who act all modest. Why? As he says, well, first of all, if the person is really modest, why start off on saying, who am I to answer this question? Basically, you're announcing your modesty to everyone. And the whole point of a modest person is not to be that way. If a modest person, or a so-called modest person, talks about how modest he is, by definition, he's not modest. So it defeats the whole purpose of your modesty by saying, who am I to answer such a question? After all, they're asking you the question because they think you're worthy of answering the question, so stop with the phony modesty, who am I to answer the question? And then he says, and if you're not really modest and you're saying it, he says, this is also terrible because, he says, hineza avon plili, this is a terrible offense. You're making believe you're modest, but you're really not modest. The ein gaiva gedola mizo. He says, that's the worst type of gaiva. one who is not really modest, but acts modest so people will think he's modest. But it's also bad, as he said, for someone who really is modest to tell people he's modest. And I think if you do that enough, you won't be modest after all anymore, because people will start respecting you for your modesty and whatever happens to the modesty. That's why the question, how could Moshe Rabbeinu write the Torah and say Moses was the most humble person? The question everyone has, and that's the greatness of Moshe, it's explained, that he was able to write that, and it didn't affect his modesty. There is a dispute. I remember when I was in high school, and we were talking about this very issue, and someone said that well, maybe Moshe didn't really know how great he was, and the Rebbe said, rebuked us. It was me and someone else were making that claim, and the Rebbe said, Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, knew how great he was. But I've subsequently found commentaries, I'm going back now to 1982 and 1983, but I've subsequently found commentaries who do claim that Moshe Rabbeinu actually did not realize how great he was. And his modesty was due to the fact that he really didn't feel that he was at the level. The Rambam would not accept that position. For the Rambam, it's obvious Moshe Rabbeinu had to know how great he was because he had certain things that no one else did. But there are other people who do think that he was his modesty was real, and that he really thought he was not as great as others, or as great as he could be. He then continues, that is the Ben Ishai, and says there's another distinction between the Meshivim, between the respondents. Some of them, when they're asked a question, they want to see what everyone says on the matter. You know, if there's a volume of responsa by an 18th century German or Italian rabbi who discusses this matter, I want to see it. Even their contemporaries, they want to see everything. And he says, this is the Sephardic approach, and the Ben Ishai approves of it. Those who have read responsa by Rav Avadya Yosef and other Sephardic authorities know it's very important to them to cite many authorities. Rav Avadya is an extreme example because he cites everyone, but the Sephardic approach, the Ben Ishai says, is cite as many as your library can contain, or as there's a Hebrew expression, a melitza, that's used by the Sephardic authorities, that you examine as many sources that as your hand can reach. I forgot now how the Melitza goes, ki ado magat, or something like that. So you cite everything you can. This is to be distinguished, he says, from what he earlier mentioned about those who have no originality. No, this isn't a question of just being what we call Chovos Levavos refers to it as a donkey carrying books. That's an old Arabic aphorism, by the way, that the Chovos Levavos adopted, that is a donkey with a lot of books. No, it's that you use all these sources and you find chidushim, new ideas, you benefit from that. You can also see that you're no longer an individual opinion because your conclusion might have been shared by someone else. However, as the Ben Ishai says, the Ashkenazim don't follow this approach. What do? They focus on the medieval authorities, the big Rishonim, and they make their decisions based upon the important Rishonim and how they understand the Sugya. And the Ben Ishai rejects this approach. He says it's not proper. This approach, by the way, is the standard approach in the Ashkenazic world. Open up Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's what you see. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who does he need to cite? The Gemara, the Rambam, the major respondents of the Rishonim. When I say the major, I mean that not everyone who lived in medieval times is, quote, a Rishon. And a few of the major Acharonim, the Noda Behuda, the Chasam Sofer. Other than that, Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't need to see other sources. And this is the typical Ashkenazic approach. But the Ben Ishai rejects this. Why does he reject it? Well, he says that this is not very good. Why? He says because the Torah is only acquired the chavura, joined together with other people. And therefore, the sages are referred to as ba'alei asupot, because they need, even the great ones need the lesser ones. And don't, and he quotes what it says, the Tana says, I have learned much Torah from my teachers, but more from my students. So it's very important, he says, to look around and find all the sources. And what do you lose, the Ashkenazim, he says? If you look around and you don't find anything, at least you examine the matter. He sees it as a sort of arrogance, that you don't feel that you need to look at what your contemporaries have to say. You might learn something. They might correct an error of yours. He doesn't say it, but other Sephardic authorities say that the Ashkenazic approach of not looking at the Achronim, not looking at contemporaries, makes no sense. Rav Ovadia says this in the introduction to Yirmiyahu HaOmer, because then who should read your book? If you're a rabbi in the 21st century, and you yourself don't read contemporaries and recent authorities, why should anyone read your book? What makes you special? You want to say, I don't have to read Achronim, but you want other people to read you. So the Ben Ishchai says, it's not a good approach. And then he goes further. He says, there are some authors, he leaves this matter, he says there are some authors who, when they point out an error in the earlier authorities, they do it with respect. They say, lichora, apparently this great rabbi misunderstood, or they say, tzarich iyun, that it's difficult. On the other hand, there are those who speak very sharply against those they think were in error. And here again, he distinguishes between the Ashkenazim and Sephardim. He doesn't say that this is an Ashkenazic characteristic, but but the examples he gives are Ashkenazim, and his whole distinction here is between the approach to response that he likes and the approach he doesn't like. What he likes is the Sephardic way, and what he doesn't like is the Ashkenazic way. One thing he doesn't mention, by the way, is that the Sephardic authorities are the lenient ones. I was a little surprised they doesn't mention that, because going back to the Chidah already points out that Sephardim are more interested in being lenient, and there's a whole tradition of this, and Rav Ovadia Yosef said when he was running to be chief rabbi of the state of Israel, he said that the Sephardim are like Beit Hillel, and the Ashkenazim are like Beit Shammai, always trying to make stringencies. He took a lot of heat for that, so I thought that this was something that he gave up. But I picked up a sefer the other day, full of interesting stuff, called Rabbeinu, written by Eliyahu Shitrit. This was Rav Ovadia's, I won't say chavrusa, he was the one who learned with Rav Ovadia every day and helped prepare his sefarim for publication. And he records in this book, it's a diary, of all the things Rav Ovadia told him, like over a 10-year period, interesting things. And in this book, you have comments like this against the Ashkenazi, and he says about Rav Yashin, that Rav Yashin, who's always stringent, he follows the approach of Beit Shammai. So what we see here is that this was a common theme among Rav Ovadia, that the Ashkenazim are always trying to be stringent. But the Ben Ishchai doesn't mention that, but he does speak about how those who speak with respect. So who doesn't speak with respect? And I guess you'd say speak sharply. The example he gives is the Raivad, with Avram ben David, the great critic of the Rambam. He says, look at the Raivad, who criticizes the Rambam, the zilzel bichvodo, and degrades the Rambam's honor, which he does, no question about it. But the rival was older than the Rambam, so he felt, I guess, he could do that. And then he says, the rival did this even though no one, who's greater than the rival when it comes to Torah and Yira? Nevertheless, he did. He treated the Rambam in a disrespectful way, and the Rambam was not honorable in his eyes. And he's right about this as well. You have this tradition, an apologetic tradition, that the Raivad really, this is all in the heat of the battle, but the Raivad really respects the Rambam as one of these great Torah sages, etc., etc. I don't think that's true. And Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg writes that it's not true. He says the only thing the Raivad respected was the way the Rambam was able to categorize things, but in terms of his learning, he didn't have that respect, and Rabbi Weinberg mentions that on various occasions, the Raivad, when he doesn't have to, needles the Rambam, sort of gives him, pokes him. And Rabbi Weinberg gave this insight on his own. This is his own original insight. Had he known what the Ben Ishvai says in the introduction to the Rav Pa'alim, he would be very happy, because that's exactly what he said. The Rav Pa'alim says it. But then look what the Rav Pa'alim says. He says to the Raivad, even though he was a great man, his mezalzel degrades the Rambam's kavod, because he didn't regard the Rambam as important. V'sof devar ma'atala. But what happened in the end to him? The sages, the subsequent sages, came and they accepted the Rambam. And they answered all the hasagot, all the criticisms of the Raivad. And the honor of the Raivad became greater and greater. V'ala al kvod Rabbeinu ha-Raivad zal, and became greater and more significant than the Raivad. Ezra Yadol, he says, tenfold. And he's right. Everyone knows the Rambam and the Rambam, but it's sort of an unfair comparison. Because to say that the Rambam's kavod became greater and greater, tenfold of the Raivad never wrote a book like the Rambam. He wrote books, but he didn't write a book like the Rambam. So once the book is accepted, he becomes greater. And he goes on that this was God's intent, that the Rambam should be raised up. So that's number one, an example. Yecheskel asks, was the Raivad the first to do such a thing? No, the Ashkenazim always argued with each other sharply. The Baal Hamor and the Raivad went after each other. So they criticized each other. He criticized the Baal Hamor. Actually, he criticized the Baal Hamor. It wasn't the Baal Hamor so much. But you have sharp comments. Ibn Ezra has sharp comments. Others have sharp comments. It was a way of, you have sharp comments in the Gemara. Some of the things that various rabbis say about each other in the Gemara are hard to take. But that's what the Ben Ishvai says. Then he goes on. And he gives another example of course, an Ashkenazic rabbi who doesn't respect his opponents and who errs. The Marshal. There you go. Yecheskel says the Marshal. The Marshal is exactly the one he quotes. Let me tell you what he says. The Marshal is with Shlomo Roya, who's a contemporary of Moshe Zisserlis in the 16th century. The great Rav Shlomo Roya, who's in the back of all of our Gemaras, who wrote Responsa, but he also had a very sharp tongue. Anyone who reads the Yamshel Shlomo knows this, and he's not afraid to attack anyone. Take a look especially in the introduction to the Yamshel Shlomo. So what does the Ben Ishvai say about him? He says, look and see what happened, the great mistake and the michshol of this great sage, Rav Shlomo Roya, in his responsa number 98. What did he do in 98? He said, he criticized, who did he criticize? It's one thing to criticize the Rambam. He criticized the Tana HaElokei, HaKadosh Rashbi, that the Marshal, Rav Shlomo Roya, criticizes Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, the author of the Zohar. This man who he criticized was the man that the Batkol decreed that he is, you know, such a great person. And what did the Marshal think about him? The Marshal thought that he was Ke'echa Michachmei Ador Shelo. The Marshal treated Rav Shimon Bar Yochai just like he's one of his contemporaries. That he could stand before him and scream. And he said that if the Rashbi was standing with him, and he said to change of practice, we won't pay attention to him. Why? Keep a rov to rov in halacha moso. Because in most matters, halacha is not like Rashbi. So before I go on with Ben Ishvai's criticism, let me read you what this was that he criticized, the responsa 98, what the Marshal is speaking about. He could refer to other matters, as he will refer to other matters. But this is one area in particular. And by the way, while I'm reading this, those of you who know your history of Achronim, and Ashkenazic Gedolim, you should be able to guess who the third Ashkenazi authority who has no respect for other greats is going to be. So he starts with the Raivad, then he goes to the Marshal, and he's going to go to another one, a third one. I'll let you guess that before I get to it. But in the meantime, let me tell you what this response of the Marshal is. 98. No, it's not the shortest. I'll tell you, because I don't want everyone thinking, and you're not paying attention to me. Rav Yaakov Emden. That's the one. And because when you say Shaga Sai, I don't know, does Shaga Sai refer to people the way Rakavemdin does? Really, he mazalzel in their kavod? I'm not even referring to Ravyonis and Ibshitz or other people like that. I'm just referring to, well, I'll give you some examples. The question in Tshuva 98, and the Marshal has all sorts of interesting and unusual tshuvot. Those who are want to see something that will shock you, take a look at his response about the inverted nuns by Ibn Soa. He thinks this is all some Kabbalistic thing and it's forbidden. And in all Sifrei Torah that have the inverted nuns, that is all our Sifrei Torah, every Sifrei Torah I've ever seen has the inverted nuns, that they're all puzzle. Because how can you go and put inverted nuns in the middle of the Sefer Torah? And he says, that's not what the Gemara refers to. So he is one of these people, the Marshal, who's not afraid of being unconventional and speaking his mind. In this response, he was asked, what the story is about putting on tefillin. Should you do it, and not just putting on, taking off also, he refers to putting on. Should you do it when you're sitting or when you're standing? Ashkenazim do it when they're standing. Sfaradim do it when they're sitting. The reason Sfaradim do it when they're sitting is because al pi ha-kabbalah, al pi ha-zohar, that's what you should do. So he was asked that. And his answer is, he begins by saying that this new practice by all these people who want to be mikat ha-makubolim, mikat is a negative term, and who want to speak negatively, the Marshal doesn't, he doesn't reject Kabbalah per se, but he rejects Kabbalists. He thinks they're a cut, a sect. So in theory, Kabbalah is holy and everything. Not that much different than today. Don't we have all these so-called Kabbalists running around? You don't have many where I live, but if you're out in the five towns, you open up that newspaper, that Jewish newspaper in the five towns, it seems like every week you have some self-styled Kabbalist coming to town who can read your palm, read your face. There's even a woman who they've been advertising, who comes with all the approbations, who can, she pours some like oil or something, can do this segula. The whole thing is somewhere between emunat tefelot and avodah zarah. I'm not sure where on the line it falls, but we have in our own day, we have the kat, members of the kat that the Marshal is speaking about. But he says that you have all these people who, and he's not just referring to the phonies that I'm talking about. He's referring to real makubalim. Because from his perspective, fine, you want to study the Zohar privately, quietly. Don't change practices, don't make it into a big deal. But what are they doing? They're trying to change everything. They're trying to create a cut, a sect of people who are makubalim, and therefore they're not going to follow what the tradition is. We have a tradition. The tradition goes back many, many hundreds of years, and yet they come on the scene and want to change it. And then he says that, so these people, he calls them the Katam Kubalim and the weak-eyed, they don't know anything about he says they don't look at the Zohar, they don't understand the Zohar, they're ignorant, basically. But they found in the works of Rashbi that, some things they follow it. So what does Marshal say? I tell you, he says, that all my teachers and my holy forefathers who served great rabbis, not one of them did this. They all followed what it says in the Gemara and the poskim. Namely, you still one standing up. And that's when he says, if Rashi would return to us today and tell us we have to change our practices, not the Zohar, if Rashi himself were to come and tell us we have to change our practices, we wouldn't listen to him. Because in most matters, halacha is not like Rashbi. So, whereas the Ben Ish Chai sees this as degrading to Rashbi, all the Marshal is saying is that don't tell me to change my practice because something in the Zohar, because Rashbi said it. Why should I change it based on Rashbi? We don't follow Rashbi in most areas of halacha. Just like we're following the Gemara. And the Gemara never accepted Rashbi's view 1,500 years ago. So why should we accept Rashbi's view now? No, we follow our minhag, our practice. And then he goes further. He says, and when Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he didn't include these things either. For example, For the Kabbalists, you don't make two brachos on tefillin. We do shal yad and shal rosh. And he says, nevertheless, we don't follow this. We follow the open halacha. He refers to Yosef Karo as Hakaro. Hey kuf I aleph reish vav. And then he says, so we don't pay attention to that. And also, what else does it say in the Zohar? Anyone remember? Know this? What does it say about if you put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed? It says that you're chayav nisa. That's what the Zohar says. So all the commentaries on the Zohar say, well, it doesn't mean it literally. You find all sorts of exaggerations. Nevertheless, it's certainly saying very harsh things that you shouldn't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Now, where's Rosh? What does the Marashal say about this? We wear it. He says, even though the people in Eretz Yisrael don't, that's because of the Rashba's position, but it has nothing to do with the Zohar. And he goes on. And then he says, he continues in saying, if these positions that you're mentioning to me were of significance, even though Rashbi said them, they're not mentioned in Gemara, if we're supposed to take them in a significant way, how is it that you don't find a remez in the Talmud, in the Bavli, Yerushalmi, Sifra, Sikta, Shiltos? You're not supposed to find anything there. We don't find anything about it. And then it says, the Yafet, he says, Rav Yosef Karo, quotes Makaro, who brought many things from the Zohar, he didn't bring these matters. And that itself is a proof that he didn't listen to them. So, therefore, what the Marashal was saying, it's not that I don't think he's putting down the Rashbi. He's simply saying we didn't follow Rashbi in his time. When the Gemara was around, the Gemara didn't follow Rashbi. So we're not going to follow Rashbi. We're going to follow the Gemara. The Kabbalist answer is, the reason is because the Zohar was not revealed. And now that the Zohar is revealed, then you follow it. If the Zohar was revealed, then they would have accepted it. So the Marashal could say, why would we accept the Rashbi? They didn't accept it. Most halakha we don't follow him. And the Mekubal answer is no. We don't follow Rashbi when the Rashbi is speaking just as a Tana using his regular intellect. Then if it's a machlokas between Rashbi and someone else, we follow the others generally. However, when the Rashbi wrote the Zohar, he wasn't just using his own intellect and understanding. He had a special divine hashra'ah, divine, Ruach HaKodesh of sorts. And therefore, the Zohar is in a different class. So if you have a dispute between Rashbi in Nigla, in open matters, versus, let's say, Rabbi Akiva, you go to Rabbi Akiva, but if it's a dispute in where the Kabbalistic side of Rashbi is speaking through the Zohar, then the Zohar takes precedence. Obviously, the Marashal wouldn't accept that, but that's the tradition that the Ben Ishai is operating on, so he sees this as degrading. Then he goes on. And then he gets to the big one and says, before we go on, one more thing. And then he points to the Marashal, his introduction to the Amshal Shlomo on Chulin. There you can really see where he attacks people, including the Shulchan Aruch. I can't remember if he attacks the Shulchan Aruch or the Beit Yosef. He might just be referring to the Beit Yosef there. The Shulchan Aruch is just the summary of the Beit Yosef. According to the Marashal, there's no need for a work of codification like the Shulchan Aruch. That was totally unnecessary. He shares the viewpoints of the Maharal's brother, Rav Chaim Metzava, who also wrote about this. And that's, if you look at the Amshal Shlomo, it's an example of how you decide halacha from the Gemara itself. Our problem is that how many people are as great as the Marashal? So the Ben Ishai says that he attacks him, he attacks the Shulchan Aruch, v'lo nahag bo kavod, he doesn't show him honor. And nevertheless, what happens? What happened to the Marashal and what happened to the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch became the standard accepted source. And not just among the Ashkenazim, as among the Sephardim, but also the Ashkenazim accepted the Shulchan Aruch and they just added on their notes, like you have the Ramah. So therefore, who wins? Again, the Shulchan Aruch wins. He then comes to the last figure, and that's the Gaon Yavetz. as he calls him. Yavetz is Rav Yaakov ben Tzvi, Yaakov Emden, because his father is the Chacham Tzvi, and he is the most harsh in his criticisms, Yavetz. He says that, he calls him actually Achron Shebagoni Ashkenaz, the last of the greats of Ashkenaz. He was not able, what he says, he was not able to withhold his pen. That is, when he had something negative to say, he said it. Not only that, he wasn't able even to spare the Rishonim of his criticism. That shows why he's more extreme than the Avitz in his criticisms. And he says, see how what he, and then he says, and see what he wrote about the Tosfos Yom Tov in his commentary on Maseches Avos. And look what he says about the Rishonim, and then he quotes the Chidah. It says, how could the Yavet say these things about the Rashba and Rabbeinu Yerucham and the Shulchan Aruch? Because contemporaries are not worthy of speaking this way about Rishonim. The Shari Le Mari. And he should be, God should forgive him that he would write this way about the Ramban, just like you speak about your neighbor. This is all from the Chidah. And then he goes on, I don't need to go any further, again, attacking Rav Yaakov Emden. Before I go on to talk about some of the significant shuvot, actually, let me go for 5 more minutes, and then I'll come back and answer your comments or respond to them. One of his most interesting and significant responsa is one permitting abortion for a married woman who became pregnant as a result of an affair. I have it right here. This is in... Chelak Aleph, Evan Ezer, Tshuva number 4. The abortion issue is, I think today people understand the halakha of abortion much more than they did when I was young, its complexity and the leniencies. Rav Avinair, for instance, has stated on numerous occasions he's against women stopping having children when they reach, let's say, 40, 42, whatever. And what does he say? He says, let them do the ultrasound, the amnio. And if they find, for instance, you know, a lot of the women don't want to do it because they're afraid maybe there'll be a problem with the pregnancy, Down syndrome, any, who knows what. Obviously, as you get older, it's the chance of a problem is more likely. Rav Avinair says, not a problem. Do the amnio. If you find that there's a problem with the fetus, abort the fetus. It's more important to have Jewish children. And this is permissible, he says, for serious medical problems you can with the fetus, you can abort it. And that's a view found not just from Avinair, others as well. So you have this idea that we're against abortion always is incorrect. And one of the most lenient decisions is the Ben Ishlai. And it wasn't just abortion. It was abortion of a... 5-month-old fetus. 5 months is, it's almost, well, it's just about viable. And yet he says that, he says he's not deciding definitively on his own. What he's doing is he's offering sources. But if you look at the sources are sources that he's only giving you sources that lead to the conclusion that there is reason to permit the abortion. If not doing so will lead to the disgrace of the family. Let me read you the final paragraph. So he cites in three paragraphs sources, including Rav Yaakov Emden, who thought that this would be permissible. And then he concludes, Venira, the Yesh Pitchon Peh, it appears that there is an opening, Laval Din Lamar, for someone who wants to argue, Hechat Ika Pagam Mishpacha, if there is going to be a disgrace to the family, Uvizayon, and Yechil Hashem, if the fetus remains, that this is regarded as a tzorech gadol. We know that you can abort when it's a tzorech gadol, a great need. So what's the definition of a great need? Some say it's only if the woman's health is in danger. He says that this, a married woman, with her husband might have been away on a business trip or something for months, she becomes pregnant, that'll be such a disgrace to everyone. He says that is reason enough. And he says, Kvar Amarti, I already said, I'm not adding anything on to this. The Eini Megala Da'ati. And I'm not giving you my personal opinion. I'm just presenting you what the other rabbis have said and show this to another Chacham, and he'll tell you what to do. But the whole point of the responsum is to provide argument showing why it's permissible. And he says it should be permissible. But halacha l'maisa, he says, I don't want to decide, but what do you do with a responsum like this? The Sdei Chemed speaks about this. Sdei Chemed quotes many who claim that when you have a posek who writes a responsum, who says that it's this is what the halacha is, and at the very end he throws in the modesty, the anaba, but don't rely on me, you can disregard the final comment of modesty, because that's just thrown in because the person's modest, and take the actual halakhic argumentation that he concludes. Others disagree. And I can see why they would disagree, because if a posek presents his arguments and then says, but I don't feel comfortable in deciding halakha maisa, don't follow me, how can you then follow him if he tells you precisely not to? But the Sdei Chemed quotes people who say, no, you don't need to look at that last line where he says halakha maisa. You look at everything up to that. He's presented the argument. He's enough of a Torah scholar that you can rely on him, even if he himself doesn't want you to rely on him. And furthermore, those final lines are just him being modest. Don't rely on me. Go ask someone else. But if a great Gadol b'Torah tells you this is what the halacha is, you can rely on him. And everyone assumes that that this is his opinion, and he is cited. Tzitz Eliezer and others cite him halacha l'maisa. But before I get to the Tzitz Eliezer, I think you'll find it significant that Rav Moshe Feinstein cites this response. And Rav Moshe Feinstein never cites the Sephardic authorities like this. He never cites the Rav Pa'alim. But this was, someone called this to his attention. He wouldn't have known this on his own. He did not have the Rav Pa'alim in his library. And this is an Igor Smosha, his famous tshuva on abortion. And all he says is that this is, it's on page 298 in Nechoshen Mishpat, part 2. He says that he calls him a Chacham Sfaradi. I don't know if Moshe ever heard of the Yosef Chaim. And he says that at the end, Ein L'smocha Dvarav Klal. Do not rely on this Rav Pa'alim at all. Nevertheless, if you look at Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, it's Eliezer, in volume 13, number 102, that's his famous, or one of his famous responsa about abortion, he cites the Rav Pa'alim. He says that the Rav Pa'alim gave us the opening to permit abortion in cases like this. Even though this has already been 5 months, the Tzitz Eliezer permitted abortion up until 6 months. And he says, we learn from the Rav Pa'alim that a tzorech gadol is not just a tzorech ruchani, it also is tzorech upgam ruchani, a spiritual and a spiritual need. And then he says that the Rav Pa'alim is also one who shows us that you can permit an abortion gamo achar shlosha chadashim, even after 3 months, because there were earlier authorities who only permitted abortion up until 3 months. This becomes obviously an important response in the Tzitz Eliezer, and others should pick up on the Ben Ishchai, because let me just read you it. So then, after quoting this matter about the adultery, how the woman became pregnant, then he says, if that's the case, if you're going to tell me that it's permitted and the pagam and the tsar and the busha, etc., or allowed the Ben Ishchai to permit an abortion in those cases because of the difficulty, etc. Certainly, in our case, when he's dealing with the Tay-Sachs baby, where it's no one's fault or anything like that, then you have permission. Or in a case of a rape, for instance. Obviously, if you're permitting a woman who has sex willingly and then becomes pregnant, and the problems that's going to cause her, Ben Ishchai permits an abortion, certainly in a case of a rape where it's not the woman's fault, or in the case where you're going to have all these terrible, the woman can't deal with the fact that the baby is being born with all sorts of problems. And therefore, he says, you can learn from the Rav Pa'alim, Lahatir, Afilu Achar Gimel Chodashim, Lo Rak B'Binyan Abu Gzer Shava, El Im Gam B'Kal V'Chomer. He says, it's a Kal V'Chomer. If the Rav Pa'alim permits it in a case where a woman commits adultery and becomes pregnant, And nevertheless, it's going to destroy her family, and it's going to be a big boosha if you can permit an abortion. In that case, certainly you can permit an abortion in other cases. Deformity to the fetus. He doesn't here speak about rape, but other posts can speak about rape. It's a kavahoma. Let me stop here. We have a number of other responses that we have to deal with, but I'll take your questions and comments now. Let me go back here. Chaim Alf says she pours lead. Yeah, that woman who comes, I don't know exactly what that means to pour lead. And I'm usually very tolerant of all these things because the Rambam was tolerant. Unless it crossed into idolatry, the Rambam permitted all these popular beliefs. He was an elitist. He didn't feel that everyone needed to be at his level. So, for example, in the Mishnah Torah, he says that if people want to write holy names or names of angels on the outside of mezuzah, he thinks it's nonsense. But they can do it because it doesn't affect the mitzvah itself. It's only if you actually write it on the cloth on the inside. Then it's you're taking the mitzvah and you're turning it into an amulet, and you're affecting the mitzvah itself. You're turning it into heresy, basically. You're putting holy names of angels into the mitzvah. Then that's when the Rambam says you have to uproot it. The Rambam says that if the masses want to believe that angels have physical forms, that's fine. They can believe that. It's wrong. For the Rambam, angels are completely spiritual, no physicality. But the masses, if they want to believe it, they can believe it. But if they say that God has a physical form, that already is heresy. It's breaks with the third principle of faith, and therefore the masses need to be enlightened. So in these matters, I've always been quite tolerant. If people want to believe this sort of thing, and it doesn't bother me, what is it, before Pesach, when they put the key in the challah, I know Rav Schachter goes crazy about this, how it's Avodah Zarah. Well, I mean, if it's, you know, even if it was once Avodah Zarah, a long time ago, no one today. Remember what I told you when I asked Rav Soloveitchik about Thanksgiving? He asked me, are you going to church? I said, no, so what's the problem? So fine. So 300 years ago, maybe the key in the challah was Avodah Zarah. But today, no one putting the key in the challah has any kavanos of Avodah Zarah. So I don't know how it can be forbidden on that respect. Now, as for the red ribbon, that's also an interesting case because the Tosefta already refers to this as Avodah Zarah, as Darchei Amori. But again, today, no one assumes it's Darchei Amori. And according to the halacha, as I understand it, if a practice, an idolatrous practice, has been forgotten, then the fact that you do it, if it's no longer in anyone's mind, has any connection to idolatry, it could be shtus and foolishness, but not everything that's foolish and shtus is Avodah Zarah. I don't know about the lead, though, or what the mechanism is, and It must be mentioned in early authorities, there you have a permission if you want to follow those authorities, but I don't know if anyone ever assumed that this was Darchei Amori or not. At least they're not doing what figures in the 19th century, Sephardic figures, who condemned the practice of lighting flames to propitiate the demons, which they said is real Avodah Zarah, because it's basically, it's an offering for the demons. You're asking the demons to protect you. That was practiced in various places in the Sephardic world. But YH says, the Chavis Chaim used the Zohar to decide some of our quotes in the Mishnah Berurah. You don't need the Chavis Chaim. The Shulchan Aruch uses the Zohar. Right? You look at the book Ben Yochai by Rav Moshe Kunitz, about whom we had classes on. At the back of it, in the middle of it, at the beginning of it as well, he lists all the halachot derived from the Zohar. The Zohar is only mentioned one place in the Shulchan Aruch. Sorry, not the Zohar, Kabbalah. Kabbalistic concept is only mentioned one place in the Zohar. I've given this question in the past. I'll see if anyone remembers it. But there are numerous halachot which are decided in accordance with the Zohar and the Beit Yosef and then the Shulchan Aruch. But a Kabbalistic concept is only mentioned one time in the Zohar. If you take a look in Hilchos Tzitzis, where he gives the reason why we have five ties on it, he refers to the Sefirot there. He calls them the Havayos. So yeah, five, he refers to that's the only Kabbalistic comment. David says, wouldn't the possible meaning of here's the halacha, but don't rely on me, that he thinks it's mutter, but that a shiloh needs to be asked to a rav so that the principle is applied properly and doesn't get out of control. In general, I think you're correct. But the question comes down to, in this case he's asked about, where a woman committed adultery and got pregnant, and he says to the questioner, he explains why it's permitted, but he says, but I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm just telling you what the early authorities said. Ask someone else. Can you then rely on him? Halacha l'maaseh. And I don't think the way you phrase it, it's not what he says. I mean, you're saying something different. Everyone, take the Tzitz-Eliezer. Tzitz-Eliezer permits abortion. He doesn't say that anyone can just read what he writes and decide on their own that you can have an abortion. It's understood that you always need to ask a shaila. The question is, though, can you rely on the Rav Pealim to assume that abortion is permissible in a case of 5 months and where it will lead to a lot of busha? And we see that the Tzitz Eliezer thinks yes, or Moshe Feinstein thinks he's mottering it. Everyone thinks he's permitting it. The only question is, why then does he not just say I'm permitting it? Does he fall back and saying, well, all these other authorities lead to the conclusion that it's permitted, but I'm not giving you my opinion, I'm just telling you what the earlier one said. Then David says, do you think that quoting many contemporary sources in the Pesach would be considered similar to common law? In other words, to converge to a common result rather than having every posting with a different theory and a different result. The Mishnah Berurah, I think, so. Well, I don't know, let me take that back. I don't know if a common result as much as I would say maximum compliance or something like that. If that's common law, perhaps, I'm not sure. Jonathan asks, was it not a sign of respect that the Ravid wrote such an extensive commentary on the Rambam's writings? That's how, if you look in the work, Kori Hadoro, that's pretty much what he says. But I don't think so. And that's not what the Ben Ishchai thought, that's not what the Weimert thought. You could say just the opposite. The Ravid is so worried that the Rambam's view is going to take over that he has to write his criticisms not as a sign of respect, but as a sign of to stop respect in the sense that he sees how great, how widespread it could become, but not that he respects the Rambam, but he thinks what the Rambam did is terrible, and therefore he has to correct him and stop him from achieving success. It's not like the Ramah. Ramoses Isserles had a great deal of respect for the Shulchan Aruch, and he's just adding on his additions to the areas where the Ashkenazic practices differently. The Ravid sees his goal as refuting the Rambam, and not providing an alternative approach, but rejecting the Rambam, not just rejecting in Halachot, but the entire endeavor. Take a look at the last criticism in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, where he says about the Rambam that this guy, I mean, he's arrogant. He thinks that he can just get rid of everything else and give us his work. That's exactly what the Ravid refers to him in the last Hasaga. So it's hard to say that he thought highly of the Rambam. David says, Rambam also says to make one bracha on tefillin, unless you put the show Rosh and Shalyad separately. Why didn't you put them on separately? How do you not put them on separately? I'll take a look. Oh, you mean, explain to me what you mean, not put them on separately. Yechesko, the system, when we choose the Zohar over halakhic sources, there's a big dispute about this. Some people say that the Radbaz and others say that if the Bavli gives the halakha, then it trumps the Zohar. Others say that if the halakha doesn't appear in the Bavli, but it only appears in a post-Bavli source, such as Gaonim or Masechah Sofrim, or if the Bavli doesn't come to inclusion, then we go like the Zohar. And others say that no, we can actually always go like the Zohar. Zohar can trump the, and not just the Zohar, the Ari too, can trump the standard halacha. So there's different opinions on the status of, and that's one of the disputes in the Iraqi community. Finally, getting to the end here. Okay, I'll look at the Rambam later. Okay, well, I'll talk about the Rambam next time. Let me just say, though, the Rambam is not the reason why the practice starts. Certain practices are changed. There's a Shulchan Aruch, there's a tradition, and then what you have is you have, with the Ari in particular, and the pushing of Kabbalah to trump the Shulchan Aruch. Not to say we're going back to the Rambam on this or that. For the Zohar, for almost every halacha in the Zohar, not everyone, but almost everyone, you could find Rishonim and sources in the Gemara. We're not saying we're going back to the Rambam or anyone else. Rather, we're saying the authority of the Zohar, or later the Ari, is what trumps the Shulchan Aruch. Thank you all. I think we'll have one more class on the Ben Yishai, maybe one in a little bit. And that'll be next week, fifth week. But there's still a lot more good stuff we have to get to. But good night, everyone. And I will take, I'll look at the Rambam and see if there's anything I want to add to that as well. Like I said about the wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed, the same thing. You have, that's a shita. But nevertheless, as he mentioned, that in Eretz Yisrael they don't. It has nothing to do with Kabbalistic reasons. But in Chutz La'aretz, the push away from wearing it, as the Maharshal says, was because of the Kabbalistic considerations, and it's that which he rejected. Good night, everyone.